These people would never in a million years say that they're making an alternative economic, political, or social system. I'm saying that. But they're the people who are experimenting and exploring these things and learning through trial and error.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 8 of Damn the Absolute. We occupy human environments that are overlapped by numerous social, moral, and political systems. Some of these systems interlock while it's unclear how exactly others relate to one another. The more theoretically minded among us, and the more ideology-craving parts within us, tend to reach for rather all-encompassing frameworks to help us make sense of what creates social and environmental ills. We look around ourselves and see shortages in nutritious food, ecological exploitation, social injustices, atomization, political radicalization, and tyranny. And depending on our ideological proclivities, we use divergent language as tools for identifying their sources in hopes of then addressing these identified problems, using terms like socialism, capitalism, fascism, or liberalism, to name a few. Abstractions or idealized conceptions like these have important roles to play, but how helpful are they in bringing about social change? What if, instead of leading out with political ideology or philosophical theorizing, we focused our efforts on meeting needs as they present themselves? What would happen if instead of organizing with an eye toward finding like-minded individuals that share our same dogmas and creeds, we targeted concrete problems that we face within particular places or communities? Ashley Colby is a sociologist and author of Subsistence Agriculture in the United States, Reconnecting to Work, Nature, and Community. She spotlights subsistence food producers in the U.S., uncovering how practitioner networks empower community members with different ideological and political commitments to come together and solve local problems. She believes that our current mass agricultural system, a central element of what she frequently refers to as industrial capitalism, is not only in crisis, but moving toward gradual collapse. Drawing from original ethnographic studies and her own experience as a subsistence food producer, she explores some of the more promising alternatives to the current system, or shadow structures, as she calls them. She takes on the misconception that subsistence farming only happens in rural areas and in the global south, highlighting food producers and chicken keepers in the Chicago area. She further expresses an optimism that as industrial farming, consumerism, and global supply chains continue to push beyond their ecological and moral limits, that permaculture and subsistence agriculture will serve as the fruitful nexus for what are becoming the next collection of social and political systems that will enable communities to thrive beyond the 21st century. Despite Colby's optimism, how feasible or desirable are these movements away from mass-scale agriculture? How much meaningful change can happen when political activists take this more practical approach to problems rather than leading out with theoretical frameworks? What role does polemical theorizing have in bringing about social change? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
We're in a bit of a habit here at Damn the Absolute of trying to always remember the fallibility of our beliefs. So what's a view you've held as an adult that you were confident wouldn't change that has actually shifted dramatically?
I think part of why I'm someone who's open to new ideas is that I'm constantly questioning whether or not the things that I think are right. I think it comes from being from a family who just, we were never very hardcore believers of anything. I mean, it's just this general middle class interest in consumerism, and there was no like hardcore religiosity or anything like that. And so when I went to college, I was just extremely open-minded about, oh my gosh, what can I learn? I did kind of go on this college trajectory that indoctrinates you of the normal liberal things to think, like plant-based diets are the way to solve everything or something like that. And so going along these normal trajectories of beliefs, but I think even now, a lot of the things I think, I'm happy to be proven wrong. I'm like super interested in being proven wrong. It's part of what has been really relaxing about exploring alternatives is just I really, really try to shy away from dogma and sticking too close to any one ideology. So that's been a really helpful skill. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say there was ever one specific thing that I was totally, totally sure of, because even if I hold it for a while, some belief system, I'm like, oh, some better explanation has come along. So I can take that up without feeling too bad about it or without cognitive dissonance.
The humility or that tentatively holding a view shows up in some of your work. And it's you're alluding to some of your shifted views on subsistence agriculture, which we'll be talking about today. Typically, when people think of subsistence agriculture, think about rural places or the global south. However, bulk of the work that you focus on is actually subsistence agriculture in the U.S., in rural, urban, and suburban settings. What exactly counts as subsistence agriculture?
That's such a good question. And I specifically use that term for political reasons. I think the global south kind of gets ghettoized as, oh, they're just so different from us. And the way that they make a living and have a livelihood is just so different. It's something we could never understand. But then when I started talking to people in Chicago who actually produce food for themselves and then got steeped in the anthropological literature about subsistence producers or peasants in the global south, I saw that there are cultural distinctions, there's cultural differences, but there's really no distinction in terms of actual livelihoods. Subsistence food producers in the global south have other livelihoods. Almost no one in the world is 100% subsistence. People are part of formal economies and informal economies both. And so it was really important to me to highlight the similarity, because I think there's a social movement goal that I have, which is about finding commonalities and building collaborations. And I think that starts by seeing our mutual experiences and livelihoods as similar to one another. And so, yeah, I call subsistence food production on purpose. I had to fight with my dissertation committee and then my editors at first for this, because it's, oh, Chicago doesn't do subsistence. And to me, it's like it's a political point to say people are growing food. It's all the same stuff. They're growing food. They're keeping chickens. They have a job that supplements things that they don't make. And we're kind of all on this path together. And that's the point.
So despite the commonalities, I'm going to push or try and pull this apart a little bit. What are some of the differences or different ways in which subsistence agriculture looks like in the United States in a rural setting versus suburban and even urban settings such as Chicago?
Yeah, the main differences in the geography obviously is just access to land and space. So I talked to some people in Chicago who made a lot of food on a small amount of land, but they couldn't push to the next level as you would be able to in a rural setting. The obvious next question related to this topic is, how do you deal with food in cities? And the answer, in my opinion, is the redistribution, geographical redistribution. A lot of the people I was talking to in Chicago were talking about, well, first of all, had partnerships with people in rural areas. So they shared back and forth, whether it was they hatched too many goslings to keep on their property. So then they shared that with the rural people, and then, you know, in return for a share of vegetables or something like that. But then a lot of the rural people I was talking to were dreaming about, or sorry, a lot of the urban people I was talking to were dreaming about rural, moving rural, or at least having some access to some land. I think that's probably the healthiest trajectory going forward. I don't have a master plan in terms of how this would all play out, but I just think that the concentration is in cities is just way too unsustainable. And the lack of concentration in rural areas is just incredibly unsustainable.
You're bringing up a point that is very big in political discourse right now, the rural-urban divide. And you're alluding to some of this cross-pollinization between these different populations. Could you talk a little bit more about ways in which you think subsistence agriculture could bridge these gaps or divides between the rural and the urban populations?
I'm working on this project right now based on all of my findings from my dissertation and my other research, which is on similar kind of sustainable livelihoods, both in the U.S. and in Uruguay, and my life here in Uruguay. And basically, I believe that a connection between rural and urban people is possible through commerce, but not just commerce, local commerce, but not just commerce, sharing of ideas and bartering and giving away for free, sharing economy. I imagine, inspired by the amazing community that I interviewed in Chicago, a lot of these people connected to one another, subsistence food producers in Chicago, and they sort of built these really interesting, beautiful networks of sharing information and sharing actual goods. They got politically active when needed, these groups. And I really imagine that there can be these, not just food sheds, but goods sheds, sheds of local areas that they're not going to be able to produce 100% of everything they need. It's okay to have laptops, but I think that there is just so much work to be done in relocalization and decentralization. And I think, in my opinion, a political connection, a political project can grow out of this basic shared need that people have. People have a need to eat. They have a need to consume a certain number of goods. People have a need to make a livelihood. And if people in and around certain local areas can connect with one another and understand who needs what and what they can buy and what they can sell and what they can share and barter, and they start making those connections, I honestly feel deeply that, based on what I learned from my dissertation, that these kinds of connections just sort of snowball into more and more connections, innovations, political power, and resilient communities, basically.
I think a lot of people who live in the United States, we think of agriculture and farming as these things that happen on these massive scales, because that's what we've largely become accustomed to. And I think in the US, the percentage of people who are actually farmers is like 0.5% nowadays, whereas before it was not. So I'm wondering, to give a little bit more context for the audience, could you detail a little bit of the history in the US from going from many, many farms that are small and owned by families to this massive scale that we're at today?
This is not a phenomenon that's only happened in the US, but the trajectory is, I would argue, is basically the same everywhere. There is the agricultural revolution. Most people have something to do, have some connection to producing food, producing goods, producing crafts. And then there's this process of de-peasantization that happens sooner in more developed places, sooner, further back in history in more developed places like Europe and the US. But more recently in other places that I would say Uruguay hasn't fully people haven't stopped becoming peasants. I don't know the verb for that. So basically in the US, the vast majority of people a few hundred years ago were part of some sort of peasant livelihood, or how I would define subsistence food producers in my study. And so it became mechanized. I kind of use the lens of fossil fuels for a lot of things. It became mechanized because we had this access to cheap energy that made these giant machines possible. Then you're able to make this food on this massive scale. And then you don't need a bunch of little farmers. You need giant tracts of land to make the machines make sense. And then it was also a result of a lot of the technological advances of war. All the chemicals invented in war processes get applied to agriculture. And it's just this industrialization process that I wouldn't say that the people who were doing it, I don't tend to ascribe moral judgments to these kinds of things. I'm like sort of a historical materialist. These things just came about because we discovered fossil fuels and knew how to exploit them. And then there just became this exploitation of the land and people and all of this that came along with that discovery and the inevitable rollout of all the technology. So I think when I'm trying to talk about re-peasantization, it's like this really, really human thing. It's just this thing that we've done a lot of for many, many years, for the vast majority of our history as a species in different ways. In the Paleolithic, it looked different than agriculture, but there's things we can learn from the Paleolithic as well and early Neolithic in terms of re-peasantization. And to me, the really exciting thing is that there's so much information now. We can make really good choices in terms of re-peasantization in ways that probably wouldn't have been possible in the inevitable de-peasantization process.
On the one hand, there's a massive amount of benefits that have come from massive scale that have made food a lot more accessible and maybe less expensive for a lot of people. And there's a lot of benefits there. However, on the other hand, there's, from a pro-environmentalist perspective, a lot of cause for concern. How desirable or feasible is it for the United States or elsewhere to basically jettison this massive scale agriculture and shift toward a more subsistence agricultural approach?
So this question I love, because I think people are like, but does it scale? And I just think the industrial system will not, it cannot continue. It cannot, it will not continue. That's just like a historical materialist in me speaking. There are ecological limits that are already being reached in a lot of places. The foremost is soil. If we are eroding topsoil to the point that that land cannot be arable unless it were, these different processes for regenerating soil can come in and will come in. So in my opinion, it's not like my political project is not, we need to raise awareness to get these people to voluntarily choose to get off industrial agriculture. My political project is industrial agriculture is inevitably going to fail for any number of ecological limits that stop it from even being able to continue. And my political project is what goes into those empty voids when those inevitably happen. And to me, thinking about these people who are, I would say, on the forefront, they're early adopters of going back to a traditional way of doing things, will be the ones who can step in and fill that void and help to explain to people what they've learned and what's possible on that scale. Not to mention that small scale farming with agroecological principles and regenerative principles has been shown to produce way more nutritious food and more food overall because of the ability to stack different things. You can do silvopasture where you can have fruit trees and nut trees in between grazing animals and such, than a giant field of wheat, for example, which is not nutritionally, it's nutritionally deficient for, you're going to compare calorie per calorie, but you can't exist only on wheat. So that's another really important, I think, counter argument to that point of view.
In the communities you've studied, Ashley, you found that many of the people that are practicing subsistence agriculture are approaching it in reaction to the needs that present themselves, healthy food, community, a whole host of other needs, rather than people who are ideologically or politically aligned saying, hey, let's get together and let's just overthrow all these systems. You found that it's a much more practical approach. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think this is key to thinking about how social change will happen, because we're all so siloed and atomized and alienated and disconnected that it's incredibly hard to try to intellectually imagine what a future would look like, and then to find somebody who agrees with you, and then to like try to make that politically possible, that imaginary scenario. And then who are you going to convince of this imaginary scenario? A politician? You know what I mean? So the people who are in my study, they basically, what they shared in their assessment of the problem was a sense of alienation. And I think that we can basically all get behind that sentiment, a sense of alienation, a sense of risk. Some people blamed it on big government. Some people blamed it on corporations. Some people blamed it on whatever. It doesn't really matter, though, because they came to the same conclusion as to the solution to that problem. And then when they came to this solution, they started finding other people who came to this a similar conclusion via something as mundane as, okay, I started keeping chickens. Where do you buy chicken feed in the Chicago area? Well, there's a couple places only. So you go to those places and you meet other people who have chickens on this scale, and you start striking up conversations. And then you are like, can I get your number? Because I'm new to this and I would love to have somebody I could troubleshoot with. Yes, of course you can. And they build these networks. And then it just becomes this practical community. And the barrier to entry is do you keep chickens? Yes, I keep chickens. Can we talk about that? As opposed to, do you believe the capitalist system and neoliberalism is to, you know, I mean, you just start getting into this really jargon heavy realm with people who are elite or college educated, who know what these terms mean, or at least think they do, or think they agree on what they mean. And it just becomes this sort of rabbit hole where we've got leftists disagreeing about what the word neoliberalism means or whatever. And I just don't see a lot of potential there. I see a lot more potential in just connecting over these very basic practical things and then building from there.
I think this example is incredibly profound. I think in the contrast in which, as you suggested, these groups that political theorizing is more of this gatekeeping action that prevents people from doing practical things of addressing the needs. And I've seen this and some of my own political activism. So I would love to hear, what advice do you have for people who tend to lead out with theory rather than the approach you're suggesting?
So I was that person and still am sometimes. So you know what I mean? It's a process. It's a journey we're all on, figuring these things out. I would primarily suggest to start to be kind to yourself in this process. It took me a good decade to start learning about theoretical things and to go through this whole loop of which theoretical perspective do I resonates with me, and then back to finding out that these practical things are really where I stand. Having said that, I believe very strongly in experiential learning. But when I was about to do my dissertation, I was talking with a fellow grad student. I said, I want to talk to people who produce food for themselves. And he said, are you going to talk to any rural people? And I said, no, because, you know, obviously I just want to talk to urban people. And I have in my mind this new urban class of elite people, more or less, environmentalists who have coming to subsistence food production for the first time. And obviously that's my sample. And he's like, why wouldn't you talk to rural people? They're the ones who do this normally. And I'm like, okay, fine, John. All right. And so then I included rural people. I'm like, all right, it'll be a good comparative case or whatever. And then I start talking to these rural people and they're so amazing. They're so ecologically connected. They know so many things that these urban people are just now discovering and acting like they invented. And so that experience of talking to those people and seeing those people's setup, the way that they live their lives, the way they did subsistence agriculture, it really opened my eyes and radicalized me and changed my whole perspective. So my advice to theoretical people is get outside of your social comfort zone when it's responsible to do so, and see people in person when it's responsible to do so. Do things that make you nervous that are different. Get involved in practical activities and see what you learn and ask yourself what you're learning and what you can learn more about and what you're curious about. Follow your curiosity, but really get into the practical zone and get new experiences under your belt, and then go home and think, what did this experience teach me? How does it fit into my framework? Am I being challenged by these new experiences? That kind of thing.
You already alluded to chicken keepers, and there's a story you have in Chicago that captures this point you're talking about of activism that isn't leading out with political theory, but by needs presenting themselves. Could you recount that story a little bit?
These chicken keepers in Chicago, they kind of naturally grew into this network. Some of them, now when I say rural people, have been doing this all along. I should caveat that by saying there are a bunch of rural or urban people who come from traditional backgrounds, for example, immigrant communities in Chicago from Puerto Rico, Mexico, Eastern Europe, who have a tradition of keeping chickens in the backyard. And so there was this natural alliance between those kinds of people who did this subsistence kind of production traditionally, and then people who are newcomers to it. And basically, there's this cross-pollination, like I said, where people kind of get to know one another doing it. And this bottom-up community that started growing. And the community only grew out of concerns for managing their own practice, their own practical activities, which is chicken keeping. But then what happened is that an alderman, which is a city council person in Chicago, proposed a ban on chicken keeping. And this sort of activated this community who now have this political stake in keeping this thing going. So to me, if I think about this as a political project, I think, would people be as likely to fight a political battle against the banning of chicken keeping if it was just a theoretical thing, keeping chickens? Or are they more likely to fight it if they have chickens in their backyard and they want to keep them? So I think there's a real power in this. So, but then what was also interesting to me, because we're told social change happens through picket lines. Well, not just picket lines, because that does happen. It does happen that way too, but demonstrations or protests. But that's not what this group did. This group first started this thing called a chicken coop tour, where they opened up their backyards to their neighbors and for anyone around the city. And this was such an intelligent tactical move, because you have all these neighbors now who their kids get into it and they're like, oh my gosh, chickens, this is so fun. And then they're willing to go to bat for their neighbors who have it, because not only they have made this superficial connection with them, this weak tie, as we call it in sociology, but they also see that it's kind of cool and they like it and they like that their neighbors have it. Whereas if they haven't had that experience, they would be like, yeah, chicken's gross. And so they made this chicken coop tour. They also shared information horizontally on this website, where they've started to crowdsource information about different cities' policies and the benefits of it. And then this group ended up winning with this strategy against this city council person who saw that there was just too much of a political groundswell to protect this activity and knew that she wouldn't be successful. So there's a huge lesson in that. And I think that there are a million different stories like that playing out that we don't really pay that much attention to, or we're not describing it as a political thing in the way that I am. But I really do think that this is the best potential way we have forward when we're talking about this political alienation we have from one another and polarization. I honestly think so much can come of this kind of communities of practice rising up to defend their rights, basically.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. Really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. There seems to be a much more comfortable interaction when people approach things from this needs-based solution, like you said, rather than having to go through purity tests or be like, hey, are you one of us? It's just, hey, we both have this need we're trying to address. And then eventually some of those more political, partisan, or ideological threads start to show themselves. But that's much later into the friendship or relationship, when I think you have some of that social capital established.
And trust, which is huge.
Practitioner networks and shadow structures, they play a prominent role in your model of social change that you embrace. How exactly do those concepts fit together?
Yeah, shadow structures. I came up with this term based on this theory that I'm using, which is Morris Berman's dual process theory. I'm not thrilled with the name. I feel like maybe I can come up with something better. I'm still ruminating on it. But Morris Berman's theory is basically societies fail. They have failed. They will fail. They only last a certain amount of time, and then some different society comes about. He uses the example of classical Rome failing for a few centuries, and then you've got the cows grazing in the forum, and then eventually the power goes toward Christianity. But in that period of time before power gets coalesced into Christianity, and then you've got the Holy Roman Emperor, you have a bunch of different a bunch of little cults that are similar to Christianity's trying out seeing what the next world order might be, and then Christianity ended up taking a foothold. So he argues that capitalism runs from 1500 to 2100. That's his prediction anyways. And we're in that last century where it's like, what's coming about? What's going to happen as these things fail? And shadow structures are these alternative means of addressing needs of a failing system. So for example, if supply chains shut down because global capitalism relies on just-in-time processing and globalized supply chains, what do you do to get food? So that's part of the idea of the subsistence food producers, is that you're making this alternative system. It's not meant to break down the system. It's not meant to attack it. It's just meant to exist parallel to it. When the larger system fails, something will come about. Some other system will, society will arise, social organization. So the question is, which of these shadow structures ends up taking hold? And my work is trying to pay attention to the most ecologically connected, most place-based, most decentralized, the best of these shadow structures that I see currently existing, trying to draw attention to those things so that when these systems fail, people know where to look for these tested solutions. So the practitioner networks fit in with that idea of a shadow structure because they're the bread and butter of the next social system. They're the ones making it. These people would never in a million years say that they're making an alternative economic, political, or social system. I'm saying that, but they're the people who are experimenting and exploring these things and learning through trial and error. And it's really important to note that these solutions are not, I don't think that they're 100% correct. I think that they're in process. And the whole point that I'm trying to make is let's get going, figuring these things out and doing some real trial and error, because I think a lot of people are stuck in this theoretical space. What shall the next whole entire system be? We've never in the history of humanity imagined the next system and then implemented that imaginary system. We won't do it now. We're really smart. We have computers. That doesn't mean that we're going to implement a system and then everyone's going to agree, yeah, that's the one, and then we're all going to do it. It doesn't make any sense. It's never happened. Why are we wasting our time talking about this? Let's go, whatever, just plant some tomatoes and then you grow from there. You start small, you do different things, you meet people who are different from you, and you start testing these things. It's trial and error.
Some people don't show that much interest in the ideological connections or these like grander narratives of what the next system could be. What happens in these communities of practitioners when people begin, some people in them start to argue, oh, this thing we're doing right here, this is a practice to overthrow capitalism? Or you have someone else who steps in and says, actually, this thing we're doing is a very capitalistic endeavor. What have you seen happen when these political theorists start to bring up these conversations in these communities?
That's a great question. It does happen. But what I would argue that it's just what happens is, okay, so one of the communities that I have interviewed recently, I don't have any publications on this yet, data yet, but I have it sitting, you know, I'm writing it up, is this group called Earthship, which is a group of people who do like an alternative type of architecture. They're based in New Mexico. They came here to Uruguay to build a hotel. And so this whole team came from New Mexico to build this hotel in Uruguay. And I interviewed this team and the people who came to the Earthship Academy to learn how to do this kind of construction. This kind of construction is so cool on its own merits. But what happens is people are too busy doing stuff to spend that much time or put that much stake in it. So these people are, they work on these Earthship construction all day, 8 a.m. to whatever, 6 p.m. or something like that. When you get home from a day like that, you start talking about theoretical things. It's funny almost. The debates that they're having, first of all, they're having these debates with friends, people they already have connection with. So they've already got the social capital that they're not going to be really, they're not behind a Twitter screen. They're actually talking to their real friend who they spend all day with every day. So they're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But then you can see the absurdity because I hung out with these Earthship people in the evening sometimes, and they're just drinking beers, relaxing. But then they like start talking about this theoretical stuff. And you can tell there's almost like a jovial quality to it because it's like, it doesn't really matter. What really matters is building this damn house or hotel. You know what I mean? So I think there's like a whole different alternative intellectual space, which is so cool and rewarding. And I want everyone to experience that because it's debate then becomes this tool for more social lubrication and more throwing ideas out there and kind of just having fun and exploring. It's almost like play as opposed to winner and loser. And I love the idea of debate and discussion as play and joyful, you know, and I think that plays into why I'm not dogmatic or ideological, because I think having these discussions I really have a philosophical disposition that having these discussions out loud and being wrong out loud is fun and important. And so, I don't know, those practical communities, it's funny, once they start getting behind an actual physical activity, those ideas don't matter as much.
To step a little bit more into that theoretical space, you've expressed a view that capitalism is failing or in crisis. and that it seems obvious to a lot of people. I talk with many people who are quite skeptical of that view. I'm not suggesting that you do this, but with capitalism or socialism, those are terms that people throw around pretty recklessly. How exactly are you defining capitalism, and why do you think it's failing?
Yeah, this is a great question. I will start answering this question by talking about the failure of language. You know what I mean? You just get labels for stuff and it doesn't mean what other people think it means. And it's just becomes this monolith. Capitalism is the problem. It's just such a, I do it myself because you only have so many characters to work with in a tweet. It's absolute failure of not just language, but shared understanding and like the atomization we have between individuals, that we don't have this shared cultural understanding of things. But the way I would define it is almost like it doesn't really matter what characteristics, in my opinion, you put on this system that we're currently in. What it is it alienates people. It disconnects people from land, and from, that's the subtitle of my book, Disconnected from Community, from Land or Nature, and from themselves and their own means of their existence. Our evolved existence is connected to those three criteria. So the system as it exists right now is just exploitative of individuals, their work, what they do with their day, their time, exploitative of nature, and exploitative of communities, or disruptive to communities. So to me, I think it is important to speak in very plain terms and to not rely on these lazy labels. I think that can really alienate people too. But sometimes you throw it out for shorthand because you don't have the time to really delve into what you mean by what you say. But yeah, that's how I would describe it, at least for myself and my own work at the moment.
To your credit, I will say you're sticking in the most concrete terms as possible, trying to minimize the theorizing that happens of here's this term I'm using and everything fits into it. And you're just trying to say, hey, here's a problem. Here's the language I'm going to use to help us act to solve this problem. So I think that's wonderful. One major criticism of this mass scale or these industrial systems you're talking about include they contribute to what is called the negative economy. What's the negative economy?
So, for example, the example I used in my talk recently is about corn, soybeans, and wheat, which are commodity crops that are the most highly grown worldwide. And in the example that I use of the negative economy from a recent talk I gave is that these commodities produce a negative economic yield, meaning they can only exist through government subsidies. So it's just one other point besides the points I'm making about industrial agriculture and generally the globalized economic system, the limits that it's reaching. I mean, it's even reaching limits by its own logic. So, you know, these things cannot continue on. They started to have a negative yield to each of these commodity crops in like 2014, 2015, around there. When people say, well, how are you going to feed so many people if you don't have industrial corn and soybean and wheat? I just think that system already is failing. It's already failed. It's failing now. So we don't even need to have that discussion. The idea is what comes next.
I see your work. And to me, I think, wow, this is an incredibly pragmatist approach to addressing climate change, which we haven't talked that much about in this interview, but access to food, building community, a whole host of things. What are some of your most significant philosophical influences?
I think so many of my intellectual influences probably wouldn't be considered philosophers, but their philosophical positions or worldviews to me have been extremely instructive. So I love Emerson and Thoreau. I love the idea of connecting with nature. I love Jack Kerouac. It's just this wild and crazy connection to life, this sense of experiences and travel. I love Eric Fromm, who's a psychologist, but his book on love really helped me understand about human connection and how important that is. I like the Frankfurt School in general. And this guy, Morris Berman, he's got like a small group of followers, but he wrote this trilogy that includes the three books, The Reenchantment of the World, Coming to Our Senses, and Wandering God. And Wandering God is about, this is where philosophy and anthropology come together for me. It's about Paleolithic versus Neolithic consciousness. And this book completely changed the trajectory of my life. He argues that Paleolithic consciousness is horizontal, meaning it's connected to present experience and connected to nature and the world that they live in. Neolithic consciousness, for this whole host of reasons he goes into, anthropological reasons, it's more hierarchical and you kind of think more about the past and the future, partially because of food storage as a starting point, thinking about we need to keep the food safe so that we can continue to exist. Anyways, this influenced me. I think a lot of people are like, all right, let's go back pre-industry. And then other people are like, go even deeper and say, let's go back to being hunter-gatherers. We can't go back. We are the brains that we currently are. But there are instructive things about understanding how our brains evolved and what that means practically for our daily lives. And going to this other related point, I truly believe that there's some things about hunter-gatherer food production, which a lot of people think, oh, it was just hunting and gathering. There was no like settlements. There were in so many examples of settlements and of orchards and tree cultivation and plant cultivation in and among ecosystems, which is incredibly instructive because I honestly feel like we could have a locally specific and ecologically specific cultivated hunter-gatherer agriculture. By that, I mean, we're trying to do it on our property, planting a bunch of fruit and nut trees. And then a lot of native tribes in the United States and the West did planned burns to keep bison population up, which was their meat source. So in this case, it would just be cattle, which actually helps build soil and can combat climate change and all this other stuff. But I think thinking about those philosophical influences has really opened my ability to thinking about solutions in this really long, wide lens, historical lens. What are we meant to do as a species in our connection to ecosystems? And that was not the intention of Morris Berman's book, but it set me on that trajectory.
Well, we'll definitely include all of those in our show notes for people who are interested. You want to dig a bit deeper into that fertile soil. Who do you find to be your most intelligent and thoughtful critics? Or maybe when you are presenting this framework, which aspects of it are most often questioned by people?
I think probably the people who they're on the same trajectory as me, but they're just slightly in or came to it for a different reason, or they have different reasons behind why they think what they do. Some people who are steeped in tech, some people who are steeped in global South stuff. And I also think I have a lot to learn from people who are not highly theoretical. And the best critiques I've ever gotten are from practitioners, rural conservative people who got me out of my bubble and the way that I was thinking about things. I'll ask some question that just doesn't even make sense to them. And then when they tell me why it doesn't make sense, oh my gosh, I never even thought of that. So a lot of the people I work with here in Uruguay, we host student groups from universities in the US to come work with and listen to Uruguayan agroecological farmers. And just seeing those interactions between the students and the farmers and myself having those interactions, and these farmers, I say farmers, they're my friends, they're my community here. It's been so enlightening because they'll be answering a question I didn't even know to ask. And it's really humbling because for somebody who's, oh, you have your PhD, that's, you know, the highest academic rank you can get. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, these people know so much more than me about things that matter so much more than the things that I think and know about. So I would say the most thoughtful critics are the farmers, honestly.
So actually, for somebody newly convinced that subsistence agriculture is the future, what advice do you have for them in getting started, whether they're in a rural, urban, or even a suburban setting, which we haven't really talked much about the suburbs?
Yeah, the suburbs are fine, too. You have a lot more space. So it's all just a matter of a scale, and it's a continuum, basically. What I would say is that beyond even food growing, and this is something I talk to my students a lot about, everybody's got things that interest them. If it's education, start trying out and learning about different forms of education. For example, my daughters go to a one-room schoolhouse that has 13 kids between the ages of 4 and 11. And it's so awesome. That entire structure is so amazing. That's an alternative. That's an alternative shadow structure. If you're into building things, start learning how to build things and meet other people who do and cross-pollinate. whether it's, if it's food, I personally think chickens are this miracle. We just have a yard. They come and eat bugs. They're free range. Not everybody can do that in an urban area, but, and then they give us protein every single day. I mean, I just, when people say, can you scale it? Is there a chicken on every highway, side of every highway? No, if there isn't, then there should be, because these things are so simple and they're so human, the levels of it. So the main advice I would give is for people to sit with themselves, ask what they're passionate about, ask what they want to spend time doing, and just start. And then if you don't like it, go try something else or try more than one thing at once. All of those things, basically everything is possible. We're remaking. Don't be overwhelmed by the fact that we're remaking everything from scratch, as I often am. Just try it. We're doing masonry work on our own building. I've never, ever laid a brick in my life. You know, you just do it. You learn from it. See what you learn, what you can get out of it. And then it just sort of, I'm a strong believer in, there is no static states. You're either in a vicious cycle or a virtuous cycle. Get yourself, if you can, tipped toward the virtuous cycle side, even if it's just a slight tip where you're starting something that's interesting to you, you're learning something from it, and then it just starts to spiral. So just take that first step would be my advice, and be calm, be kind to yourself. You're not going to figure out everything ever at once.
Ashley, I appreciate the dynamism, the communitarian ethos, the focus on experience and experiential learning. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.